Hi, everybody. My name is Bob, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank the Valley Group for inviting me to speak. In fact, I got the nod like in January. And a friend of mine, Mike's put back then, and he put my name in the hopper, and here I am. So it's good to be here. It's good to be here. My sobriety date is March 3rd, 2013. But that was the day I had my last drink and last drug. I was introduced to AA in 1986. So I'll get to that a little later. You know, every time I have an opportunity to speak, it really depends on the group and where I'm at in my sobriety and where I'm at. There's a lot of newcomers here today. And so I want to talk a little bit about being new and how foreign this program can be and just a lot of nuances to it. You know, I grew up in San Francisco, South San Francisco, actually. Both my parents are from San Francisco, born and raised. I'm the oldest of four boys. I have a twin brother and the two younger brothers, but we're about 2 years apart. And, I was very fortunate. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but we never wanted for anything. I mean, we had food on the table. We had, well, clean clothes. But we also had school clothes, and we had play clothes back in the day. We didn't have sweats or anything like that. You keep your school clothes clean, or you're going to feel like you stole something. Because we had to make that last until the next school year, you know. So we were fortunate. My mom, both my parents worked. My mom always worked a graveyard shift, and my dad worked another. So there was somebody home with us when we were little. And then when we got older, my mom would work. She worked at Montgomery Ward's actually for about 20 years. And my dad was in the printing business. My dad was a very talented man. He could play piano by ear. He could draw. He was just a very, very bright man. But he had demons as well. And we wouldn't know about that until we got older. But we were introduced to sports, and you're going to hear about some sports because that's my background, and that's a big part of my life. And having three brothers and a dad, which was another child, very competitive family. I grew up very competitive. Every day after work, we were doing something. Who can beat who? You two against you two. Now, you know, I always was paired with my youngest brother because it made it fair, you know. So we learned how to compete. We learned how to really hate each other because my dad would pit us against each other. And whoever won got favor from my dad, and whoever lost didn't. And, you know, when you're little, you know, you want the accolades from your dad. You want that hug. You want that attaboy. You want that good job, you know. That's what I started living for. I mean, and you know, even at an early age, I knew I had the isms and alcoholism. I remember I was four or five, and there was a tryout for this Pee Wee League team in South San Francisco, but you had to be six to play. So I would sneak, and I had to take my twin brother everywhere. If he didn't go, I didn't go. And he was a little slow, and so I would lie about certain things and go to these practices. Because my dad never said no to us. If we wanted to play catch, he'd be playing catch with us. If we wanted to shoot hoops, we shot him. Throw the football around, he threw the football around. He never said no. So I was sneaking off to these practices, and one day there's a knock at our door, and there's a man there with a uniform, and my dad's like, "Who are you?" He goes, "I just want to let you know that your son made the team. Here's his uniform." And my dad's like, "What are you talking about?" He had no idea why I was doing it. Then come to find out, I was only five, and then once they found that out, I couldn't play on the team. So my dad was proud of me and pissed off at me at the same time. Because number one, why didn't you take your brother? Attaboy, good job for making the team. Don't ever do it again. So of course I got beat. I got spanked. I should say beat. But he did it with a smile, which made it more sinister. But anyway, so that right then and there, I was manipulating my parents by lying already at a young age. But I knew it clicked. If I did something good in an area of sports or good grades, I would get favor with my dad. And eventually that would turn into a love-hate relationship as I got older. So You know, like I said, we growing up, we never really wanted. My mom and dad hardly drank. And so I never saw my mom drunk, and I never really saw my dad drunk until I was about 13 or 14. And that's when I started smoking weed at about that age. But also my dad was doing some other stuff. And he started to change a little bit. And then my mom and dad were fighting a little bit more, and he started drinking a little bit more. And so there was a lot of yelling and a lot of fighting going on. And I come from a big Mexican family. So loudness is not a bad thing. I mean, if you want to get heard, you got to be loud. So my mom was, you know, I come Portuguese, Mexican on my dad's side, Irish on my mom's. Very small family, huge family. Yeah. Up in San Francisco. So Mondays and Wednesdays and Saturday nights, we'd go to my grandmother's house for dinner. And there'd be 40 people there, easy, you know. And then only Thanksgiving is when we went to mom's side of the family, because she had a real small family. Never saw any of them drunk. And I never saw anybody drunk on my side of the family either, but come to find out that my grandfather was drunk probably all the time. And then I had a couple uncles that were drunk. But you never heard the word alcoholic. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So growing up, things started to change a little bit. But what I started to see is that, okay, not only did I started to get favor with my dad by being good in sports, if you're good at something, people kind of want to hang out with you and they give you stuff. And so I started to get that sense of entitlement at a young age. We didn't have a lot of money. It wasn't until I got into high school when people had cars, they could go on ski trips, they could do all this. And I'm like, I had three jobs. I had a paper route, I was working at the mall, Macy's Women's Shoes, and I worked at a kiosk at Orange Julius. Remember what those are, what that is. And I always had money saved up until in high school I found out what cocaine was. And I do talk about other things other than alcohol because that's part of my story. But it'll wean down to where I cross the line and it was just alcohol. So from having three jobs and a bunch of money in the bank to having no money at all, to getting it fronted to me, and always my check is always going to the dealer. Our dealer was our shortstop. And so I always thought early on that I had a cocaine problem. So I didn't do a lot because I always had stuff to do on the weekends. I was playing in tournaments. I was doing something. So I wasn't really over crossing the line anytime soon. It was just for fun. Friday nights here, Saturday nights here, nothing big. But I enjoyed the way it made me feel. And when I first had a couple beers, it just changed my perspective. Because I was always really shy. I would turn – if I got embarrassed, I would turn beet red. I would start crying. And I hated that feeling. It was brutal. When I drank – I had all that fear just dropped. And what I learned in here over the years that I was so fear-based, I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of being embarrassed. I was afraid of being shown up. I was afraid of not getting any kind of attention. And I learned those things in here when I got sober in 2013. At 53 years old, I started to learn how to live. I did not know how to live. Everything was transactional. If I do this for you, what are you going to do for me? And that's how I knew how to live. You know, my morals weren't good. You know, everything was based on what did you drive? Where do you live? What kind of job do you have? Well, I was fortunate enough that after high school, I got a scholarship to play baseball at the University of San Francisco. And went there, and I started drinking more because there's no supervision in college. You don't have to go to class. At a bar on campus. The only place I did real well was on the field. And, in fact, my sophomore year, my coach came to me and goes, you know, did you realize you weren't even registered last year? I'm like, what are you talking about? Because, yeah, if we were good, because we were terrible, we would have to forfeit all these games because you were not registered. And I'm like, well, that's your job. What do I have? Again, pass it, blaming someone else. So eventually I transferred to Fresno State and played baseball there for a couple years. But my drinking had increased. You know, I had the reputation now, he's the party guy. All the scouts that were looking at me, that was in their notes. He's a party guy. He's not responsible for this and that. Yeah, I'm a left-handed pitcher. I could throw in the mid-90s. But that label that they gave me was keeping me from getting drafted. And eventually I ended up playing for the Fresno Giants. They had a single-A team in Fresno. In fact, I play over here in this field over here sometimes. But eventually – the drinking started to get more and more to where the next day for a game, I'd be shaking a little bit, and I'd be trembly, and I wouldn't be confident. I knew I was good. Like, for instance, I was sitting over here yawning, and I know, so when I get nervous, I get tired, you know? So when I yawn, I know I'm comfortable enough to do this, and that's what I did before every game. You know, some people throw up, some people, it's, people do different ways of dealing with nerves, and so, but I, it wasn't that anymore. It was, I was getting more nervous, and I was shaking, and so what do I do? I would drink more, and eventually, I hurt my arm, and that kind of ended my baseball career. So I'm 27 at the time, and no, 26, and so I'm thinking, what's the next thing to do? You know, my baseball career's over. I got to get a job. So I was bartending a lot. In the off season, I would tend bar. My uncle had about 3 bars up in the city, San Francisco, and he was a pool hustler. That's how he got all his bars. And so I would tend bar for him, and eventually I would move down to other places and tend bar on the peninsula. And so I go, you know what? I guess the next best thing is to get married. So I got in contact with an old girlfriend at Fresno State, and we got married. And I'm like, but she was a flight attendant, and I was still trying to keep my baseball career. So she was based in L.A. I was based in San Francisco. We never saw each other. It's the best relationship I ever had. Because, I mean, I was still living the drug life and drinking life and going out. And the ring didn't mean anything to me. Vows didn't mean anything. It was just I was a very selfish individual. If things got tough, I would cut and run. And being an athlete, like I said, people would just want to give you things, and you were treated a certain way. Well, I wasn't playing baseball anymore, but I still felt that sense of entitlement that, hey, what you don't treat me special? What about this? What about that? And eventually we moved in together, and I started a sales job with Minolta, and it was my first real job. I had to wear a suit. And it was, I ended up doing pretty good. But the thing is, the more money I made, the more drugs I did. But what happened was, I didn't come home. She went on a flight. She came back home. The front door to her home was wide open. I had been gone for 4 days. Thank God nothing was stolen. So she was home when I got home, and she goes, "That's it." So I thought we were going to marriage counseling, and we're sitting in this office in a hospital in San Francisco. And she drops a bag off, and she goes, "You're staying here for 30 days, my first rehab." So I learned what resentment was my first week. I never really knew what it was until that very first week. And so that was my introduction to my first rehab and then Alcoholics Anonymous. This was 86, 87. So we'd have classes during the day, and then we would have to go to 3 meetings at night. Now, the first meeting was dark. Underneath the church, smoky. If this is when people could smoke, you could barely read whatever. I had no idea what this was. You couldn't even see the pages. So I'm like, this is weird. But you know what? I get out of the treatment center for an hour, so no problem. The second meeting was same 7 o'clock, but it was underneath Grace Cathedral. Now Grace Cathedral is a huge church in San Francisco, and it was a chip meeting, and there must have been 400 people there. Everyone looked beautiful. It was like, now this is AA. I like this. Because it was like a big bar without booze. And when I got out of that first rehab, I hung out with the same people. I went to the same places. I just didn't drink. I just white-knuckled it. And that's very hard to do when you're just doing coke and not drinking. It's very difficult. I did that, and my wife never did drugs. She never drank, so she had no idea I was doing it right under her nose. And so eventually, about 15 months, we got a divorce, and I continued to party and do my ways, and it was no big deal to me. You know, it was like, whatever. And she had just moved in. We just moved into a brand new house. She was going to surprise me when I got out of rehab. We moved into a new home, and I'm like, I'm out of here. I didn't even think about all the effort and hard work she put into doing that. Again, me being selfish, you know, me being selfish. So that was 86, 87. In 1989, I'm not showing up to work. I got fired from a job at Minolta. I had won a trip because I was a top salesperson. When I was there, I was good. I wasn't there a lot because I kept calling in sick. But I won a trip to the Bahamas. And so the week before the trip, I don't show up to work for 4 days. I'm partying before the cruise. And I go into the office one day, and they go, "You're not going on the cruise. You're suspended for a week, and we'll talk when we get back." Well, I go, how dare you? I've already done this. This is for services rendered. You owe me this. And they go, "No, we don't owe you anything. You haven't been to work in 4 days. We don't even know where you are." Back then, they had pagers. They had cell phones. And I never would return a call because I knew who it was, and I was too high, so I didn't want to deal with it. So I quit right after that. I quit, and I got a better job, making about 40 grand more a year, and it was salary. The sales job I had was commission. And so I'm like, well, see, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. You know, I deserved it. So all in my mind, I'm blaming other people. It's not my fault. I must not be that bad if this company wants to hire me for more money. And that went on for a while. I kept getting better, fired and getting a better job, getting fired, getting a better job. And I knew I had a problem with drugs. The drinking never even crossed my mind. And then in 1986, it was my second rehab. It was up in Napa. And I went, and this time I listened. I was paying attention, and we went to meetings, and I go, "You know what? Maybe I am an alcoholic. Maybe I am an alcoholic, because when I start drinking is when I want to start doing drugs." And so when I got out that time, I had met a girl there, and, you know, it's funny. I work in recovery now. I work for My Time in Fresno, and it's just people just hook up. These young people it's amazing. But the thing is, I did the exact same thing. I met my son's mom there, and we got caught twice. And nothing serious, but if we didn't get caught, it would have been. She got out, and boom, she got pregnant. And then I'm like, there's no way it's mine. I was told I couldn't have kids. You whore. You know, I got all pissed off. So we got checks. Sure enough, it was mine. So we were getting married, and her parents, they were both professors. One was at Cal, one was at Stanford, very hoity-toity. And they tried to buy me off. They didn't want me in their daughter's life. They came from the wrong side of the tracks. And then I said, nope, not going to happen. That son's got a baby's going to have my name. And it did. So it was Bobby Brent Marquez. That's my son. He's 31 now. But because after the baby was born, I kept drinking, I kept partying. Both their parents got positions in Georgia at the University of Georgia, and they went, and Andrea took Bobby with him. So at 3 years old, Bobby's now living in Georgia because I'm drinking and using, and I'm like, go ahead, I can't be a good dad, which was a terrible mistake on my part. I put drugs and booze before my child. And that's just, you know, that's... I made a good amends to him about that because that was brutal. But I continued to drink, and then one day I was thinking, I was doing a line, and I go, you know, if I keep doing this, I'm going to have a heart attack. And boom, I just stopped doing it. I crossed the line, and I started drinking. Like it was no tomorrow. So I'm drinking. Now my jobs are getting less and less. I'm making less. I even worked for the Hispanic Yellow Pages. I don't speak Spanish. I was taking any job that was being offered at the time. And I was living in sordid places, and my life is miserable. And I'm thinking, what happened? Where did it go wrong? And you hear this. You have so much potential. Da, 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 da. So I'm at a job, and I've been there for about 3 years. But I'm getting ready to call in sick again. And it's a Sunday morning. I'm shaking so bad. And I can't think of a good excuse. I'm done with excuses. And so I have to call my boss directly. So I call her. She answers on the first ring. And she goes, what, Bob? What do you want? I'm like, oh, shit. And I can't think of anything. And so I just blurted out. Glenda, I'm an alcohol. I'm a fucking drunk. I need help. And it was dead silence. And she started crying. And she goes, how can I help you? I never expected to hear that. I never expected to blurt out, I'm a drunk. I need help. She goes, give me 5 minutes. She called me back in 5 minutes. She goes, you got 8 weeks to get your life in order. You got a job when you're done. I started crying. I dropped to my knees. I go, God, if this isn't the time, I don't know what is. Please help me. And from that day is the last time I ever had a drink. The obsession was lifted to drink. That's a miracle. That's how I know there's a higher power. Because I could not stop on my own. It says no human aid can relieve us from our alcoholism, and it's so true. I tried everything it says in the book, and I couldn't do it. But once that happened, there's work to be done. And instead of going into a rehab, AA popped into my head. I hadn't gone to an AA meeting in 15 years. That's God right there. Doing for me what I could not do for myself. It's one of the promises. And so I found 2 meetings, and I hit AA hard. And I got a sponsor right off the bat. Now, I had been around AA for about 20-something years, but never in. I only went to AA when I got caught for something. If I got a DUI, if I was going to get fired from a job, if I didn't come home, you need to go to AA. So when I'm told to do something, I don't do it. I'm not good at that. But this time I wanted it for myself. Now, my thing was, I do not want to die an alcohol death. So my son, someone asked, what happened to your dad? Oh, he died an alcoholic death. I didn't want to leave that legacy for my son. But when I went into rehab in 2013, my son already had 2 years sobriety, and he was only 20 years old at the time. So I was very proud of him, and so we reconnected through the fellowship, and our relationship has just been so much better, even though he still lives in Georgia. The fact he's going to have his first baby, I'm going to be a grandpa for the first time. So that's exciting news. So I just started doing everything it suggested. I started listening. Like I said, I got a sponsor, and I had to find, it says, step two, you know, you got to find a power greater than yourself. And because I was doing it my way. And there's one paragraph I want to read to you guys. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances are. Now, you may think, man, oh, what, that doesn't pertain to me. You don't even know my life. Da, 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 da. I was like that, too. Here's my concern. Who's going to pay rent? I don't have any gas money. The old lady's pissed off at me. All those things are otherworldly. All right, they're not spiritual. The promises are all spiritual. There's not one thing in there that's material. And people's like, well, those promises for you are halfway, if we're painstaking about this, that means working a good program. There's effort to be had, okay? This is a simple program, but it can be difficult. You know, for me, getting into the rooms again was hard. But once I got in, I did not want to leave. I didn't want to go back to that life. So I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I truly believe that events have to line up to where you got to say, I'm done. And you got to mean it. And you got to reach to the hand of God and say, I need this. Now, it says a power greater than yourself in the steps. That's kind of like to trick you a little bit. You know, power greater than yourself, group of drunks, good early direction. It could be any of that. But eventually, like it says, we're going to start talking about God. And for me, that is my higher power. I have seen miracles. Okay? Every one of you guys being in this room today are miracles. You guys don't even know it. But there's more than one miracle. You know? There's more and more, especially when you start working with people and they get it. That's the miracle. Like it says, you can't give away what you haven't got. So you got to keep giving. And that thing, the glass is full. The more you pour out to others, the more God's going to fill. It's never going to be empty. And that's the most beautiful thing about this program. It is divine. You got people that say it doesn't work. Well, really? Did you work it? You got to work the fucking program. There's no joke about that. And, you know, and the thing is, it's changed my life. I have 9 years, and I'm very proud of that. You know, I used to love chip meetings. Every 30 days, I would get my 30, 60, 90. I looked forward to that because up until that point, at 53 years old, when I finally came into this, I had not achieved anything. Okay, I wasn't an athlete anymore. I was just a man. I'm just a man that can't hold a job, that steals, that's a liar, that's, you know, all that shit that I became, that I was so ashamed of. And then now, that past helps me work with others. Because if you stick around long enough, you're going to hear your story in these rooms. you're going to hear it. That's how we relate to one another. Then you can go, if you have the courage, to walk up to that person and go, man, I can relate. I did the exact same thing. Where you think no one's done the same thing. We're not unique. You're garden variety drug addicts and drunks. That's it. You know, we're not special. And once we get to that point where we believe we're not special, that's when things start to happen. Okay? Because we got to just turn it over. That's a tough one. Turning it over. Well, I did all the footwork and everything. I just turned it over to God. I thought it was magic. Here, God, take it. God, send me some money now. It doesn't work that way. But the funny thing is, every time I thought it was a dire need, because when you're in it, you don't think you're ever going to get out of it. Believe me, one day at a time, you do. But the funny thing is, a couple days later, something would happen. It's like, God was there. Every single time, it worked out okay. Every time. So that's it. At that point, I go, and I was about 5 years in. Like, you know what, God, I'm so sorry for pulling it back after I get put in your hands. From now on, I'm going to put it in your hands, and no matter what happens, good or bad, indifferent. Because if it's not the outcome I want, maybe there's a lesson involved. But mostly, it turns away. And so I kept an open mind. You know, in the spiritual experience, it talks about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. These are essential for recovery. They're indispensable. You need those three things to get this program. And if you have those, it's going to be a little bit easier. But it takes time. In the big book, it talks about every time you finish a chapter, what does it say? Faith without dead is works. We need action and more action. You got to keep moving forward. You know, I see a lot of newcomers, and here's their favorite. I'm bored. What am I going to do? Okay, there's one of serenity. You probably haven't had any of that in your life for about 20 years or whatever. Enjoy that. Enjoy it. And if you're bored, pick up the big book and read a little bit. You know, put the phone down. Unless that's where your big book is. But, I mean, it's so funny. You're going to hear a lot of cliches, all the sayings that you hear. The reason you hear them over and over and because it works. This thing has been going on for 80-plus years. It saved millions of people's lives, and nothing barely hardly has changed except for the stories in the back of the book because it's more relatable. But the big book itself, the 164 pages, the solution is in those pages. Don't cut yourself short. Don't sell yourself short. Give yourself an opportunity. You have no idea. It says, no matter what your present circumstance is, your life is going to get better. Listen, I don't make a ton of money, you know. But I have what I need. You know, I have the opportunity and privilege to come and speak to you guys. I have good friends that come down to listen and to support me. You know, today I have friends, true friends. I never had friends. Like I said, it was always transactional. You know, it was nothing like, I'll help you just cause I'll help you. It's altruistic. There is no, it's not that good motive on top of a bad motive that it talks about in the book. I was a master manipulator. I was a liar. And I got away with a lot of stuff. I burned my parents so many times, and they never said no when I was in a jam. And back then, you know, it's not like today where I would steal checks out of the back of their checkbook. Because they wouldn't get their balance sheet for like a month. So, and then all of a sudden, I had no idea, everything started bouncing. And, oh my God. And they didn't make a lot of money. And I would burn them, not once, not just over and over again, but they never said no. And so both my parents have passed. I know they're looking down on me. I kind of wish I would have a living amends to them if they were still alive today. But listen, I'm sober today. As my friend Mike always says, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. It really is. But it takes two things. You got to be ready. This does not work if you're not ready. And you have to find a higher power, which is God, to help you. Because you got to replace that hole. That drugs and alcohol that you're not doing anymore, you got that hole. You need something to cope with. We don't have coping skills. We got drugs. We got booze. So this program teaches us to build new ways to cope. They're called the tools, spiritual tools. Kindness, love, forgiveness, patience. I got to work on that every single day. So just for today, I'm honored to be here. I appreciate every one of you guys, and thanks for having me.